Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. It's great to have you with me. We're going to be talking about AI today, specifically generative AI. There's a lot of different kinds of applications that go under the name AI these days, and we're talking about the kind of AI that comes out as large language models. You may have heard of ChatGPT, and there are others that do this, that generate text. And I have a question for you. Have you used LLMs? Or we could just say it in terms of ChatGPT. Have you used ChatGPT? For many people, what they use ChatGPT for is to create text. I mean, you can use ChatGPT for other things. Sometimes people use it to essentially look up something almost as a replacement or an adjunct to a search engine search. But specifically here, I'm asking, have you used it to generate text, a block of text, maybe a couple paragraphs or longer? You hear about these stories about students in high school or college who will ask ChatGPT to write their essay for homework, and then they turn in the essay, and then the teacher or professor has to spend time trying to figure out which of the students used a large language model to generate the text that got handed in. The reason I'm asking this is because this is becoming a real issue of people using AI, large language models, to generate text that they could have written themselves. And notice that I'm saying the words generate, that these LLMs generate the text. I'm not saying that these generators actually write the text. And the reason for that is because there's a very good argument that AI does not and cannot write in the way that we understand writing as an activity or as a practice. And to make that argument, we're going to be speaking today with John Warner, author of a new book that I recommend that you take a look at if you are interested at all in this topic. The book is called More Than Words: How to Think About Writing in the Age of AI. We're going to play that interview here in a moment. If you would like to get links to the book, actually, John Warner has written a number of books, and they're all listed and linked on the playlist. If you go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, click the playlist link for the John Warner Show. You'll see those links there. And there are also a couple of links to a couple of stories that I may have time to talk about after the interview. But first, let's listen now to my interview with John Warner, author of More Than Words, here on Tectonic. John Warner, welcome to Tectonic.
Very glad to be here.
Great to have you on the show. I'm excited to talk with you about your new book, More Than Words: How to Think About Writing in the Age of AI. It's published by Basic Books, and I really enjoyed it. This is a book that explains what writing is in order to show that AI and tools like ChatGPT can't write. Now, you have taught writing and you've written books about writing, so you have plenty of authority here. What is actually going on when we write?
So there's a few things that I try to convey to people that's important to consider when we think about writing. One is that writing is thinking. You almost can't help but think as you write. It's not the only way to think, but it's a great way to think if we sit down and spend our time writing. And it's thinking across two dimensions. One is we have this idea in our head when we try to write, and we're trying to capture that idea. But then as we're trying to capture the idea, our thoughts are working on it, and we end up altering the idea. So the shape of the thing we thought we sat down to create alters through the act of writing. And that's a kind of, I even think of it as kind of like miraculous thing that we lose sight of the miracle because it becomes so commonplace for those of us who spend a lot of time writing. And unfortunately for the students I've taught over my career, It is sometimes a foreign experience to them because of the nature, the way they've been taught to write in school, sort of filling in templates like a five-paragraph essay or some other prescriptive process. So if we can pause and think, oh, writing really is this experience of mining our thoughts and having our thoughts alter our perceptions around the idea we thought we had, it's pretty amazing. Writing is also feeling, right? When we write something, we're experiencing the emotional reality of what we're getting on the page. And depending on what we're writing, that may have different dimensions, but we're still feeling things. And writing, of course, is communicating. Fundamentally, when we sit down to write something, we have an audience in mind, or should have an audience in mind, that is going to receive this and take this in turn, and then hopefully reciprocate with some communication of their own. This is a inextricably, fundamentally human process that is not replicated by large language models like ChatGPT.
Yeah, and you also quote one of my favorite essays by Wendell Berry called Life is a Miracle, where he dives into this idea a little bit about the experience of life and how we can take it for granted or devalue it in a lot of ways. But when you think about it, it really is miraculous that we get to be embodied and we get to have thought and feelings and memory and everything that comes along with that. In contrast, in great contrast, we have these large language models, AI-based tools like ChatGPT, and there are others from the other big tech companies. I liked how you put it when you said, large language models do not write, quote unquote. They generate syntax. They do not think, feel, or experience anything. They are fundamentally incapable of judging truth, accuracy, or veracity. Okay, you said a lot in that one quote, and those are fighting words for a lot of the tech bros out there because they would, I'm sure, dispute a number of words that you brought up there. Of course, they can judge truth. Of course, they do think. I happen to agree with everything that you just wrote in that segment. What is the pitch that we're getting from Silicon Valley about these large language models and writing, and how should we think about those promises?
So these companies want you to believe that these are thinking, feeling, reasoning genius machines. They know more than we do about everything. Well, not the stuff we really know a lot about, but we don't know a lot about a lot of things. So it knows something about everything and it seems more intelligent than us. When we query about some subject, we don't know. The interface they've built, these chatbots, right, which say thank you or please or how can I help you or apologize when you say that they've gotten something wrong and say they'll do better next time, are very deliberately constructed illusions to create a relationship with this technology that cannot do any of those things. And even if you press these people who would say, oh, we have a reasoning model, or clearly there's some sort of intelligence here, they will admit, well, there's an intelligence, but it's not human intelligence. It's reasoning, but it's not the way humans reason. And this is important because at its heart, all the technology is doing is fetching syntax in response to a plain language prompt from a user. And the fact that this process of fetching syntax can create sensible responses is truly amazing. And I don't discount the incredible technological feat of developing these large language models and the breakthrough that this represents. But it is a fundamentally different thing than what happens when we write and when we communicate with others. And to believe otherwise is to just give ourselves over to an illusion. One of the things I hear from folks, because I go around talking about this stuff. I spend a lot of time talking to schools and colleges about this technology because of my background teaching writing and having written a couple of other books about how we teach writing. And I'll have somebody at every place I go say, well, I it's great because it helps. It's my thought partner. And that's fine. If somebody wants to chat with their large language model as their thought partner, I think that's great. If it helps them do their work, God bless. But it's important to recognize that every thought in that partnership belongs to the human. The large language model had no thoughts. And the image I have in my mind is like when I was a kid and I wanted to play tennis, but I didn't have anyone else to play tennis with, I would go hit the ball against my garage door. That's not tennis. That's hitting the ball against my garage door. And so that could help me get better at tennis, right? And like the door was sort of uneven, so the ball could shoot in any direction and you had to improve your reflexes and whatever. This is fine. But it is not the same thing as engaging in a back and forth with another human being because it's going and fetching syntax according to probabilities. I'll say it again. That's an amazing thing that this technology can do. This is incredible and it's mind-blowing, and I still have a hard time wrapping my head around it sometimes, but that's all it's doing. And to equate that with what happens when humans write is just fundamentally a mistake. Now, it doesn't mean this doesn't have technology isn't useful in generating syntax that may fulfill some purpose. But if our purpose, our underlying purpose requires writing, we should not be outsourcing it to this technology.
Yeah, as you put it, fetching tokens based on weighted probabilities is not the same process as what happens when humans write. You also quote Emily Bender, an AI expert, who had a nice phrase about this. You might as well be asking questions of a magic eight ball for all the connection to reality and understanding it has, which seems right to me. I think what really gets to me, and maybe it's the same for you, John, is you use the word illusion. I would even intensify that and use the word deception, because the hype coming from these companies is presenting these stochastic parrots, these large language models, as just short of sentient beings. I mean, they can't wait for the day when they can claim that these are sentient and then they deserve legal representation so that we can legally no longer say anything mean to one of these things. They can't wait for that day. We're not there yet, but you can see it. AGI, it's just 12 months away. They're just so excited about that. But the reality is, as you say, there is no understanding and there is no actual process of writing. Yeah, it's like if someone took the garage door and said, "I have built Tennis Mate 3000," and don't say
Yeah.
anything mean to Tennis Mate
Right.
3000
Well,
because
you put a brick wall at like right at the net, right? And say this is the greatest tennis player ever, but it's just a brick wall, right? You bring up a really good point about this, which is it's important to think about this technology, I think, across a couple of dimensions. One is to, as I try to do in parts of the book, isolate the technology itself and to say, apart from its creators or its origin story, which is, as not great around the exploitation of labor, around the environmental degradation that this stuff promises, around the theft of copyright that these models are trained on. All that's bad. And I think I even say in the chapter that I write about that, like, there is a good case that we should just chuck this stuff now and not look back. That's not going to happen. So there's the technology itself, and I think it's on us to understand what this stuff is and treat it with appropriate respect and consider its potential for enhancing humankind. It doesn't really do much for me as a writer, but other people say it works well for them. And certainly generative AI technology, aside from writing, I actually think writing is sort of the worst application of this technology. Outside of writing, it's having actually a lot of good effects in areas like healthcare or business or things that I'm not an expert in and don't spend a ton of time thinking about. So there's the technology, but then there's also the companies and culture and economic structure that attaches to the development of this technology. And I think what you highlight here is that these companies are engaged in a confidence game to try to get us to maintain our faith in the revolutionary transformative nature of this technology so that they can keep getting money to keep operating, because these companies don't run at a profit. Even like ChatGPT subscriptions, $20 a month, cost much more to run the servers that produce the outputs than $20 a month. So their fundamental business model would be like a restaurant that charges you $10 for a meal, but it costs them $20 to make it at this point. So they are engaged in this process to make us believe that there is some kind of inevitability, around that AGI, around a super intelligent machine that will solve all our problems, right? It'll solve our energy problems. It will unlock unbelievable prosperity. But even if you assume that that's going to happen, that's not a necessarily great scenario for people either. And I'm not even talking about like a Terminator style AGI that wants to just wipe us out. I'm just talking about a society where we have this machine that can apparently do most things humans do better than humans. I'm a skeptic even on that part of the question. But if that is a scenario we're heading towards, my belief is we should be grappling with that by centering humans, right? What is good for humans with this technology rather than how do we pump $7 trillion into Sam Altman's vision for AGI, right? $7 trillion, which is what he's asked for, which is also, as I point out in the book, seven times what we spend on all of education, kindergarten through college, annually in the United States. I mean, imagine what even a trillion, an extra trillion would do there. He wants seven of those. You know, at the end of the book, I talk about how we have to make this a public problem. Part of it is waking up to the cultural narrative they've created around the technology and the kind of economic structures that fund that rather than something else.
I think it's important to point out, as you alluded to just there, that in this book, you are not issuing a categorical condemnation of ChatGPT and large language models and AI, whatever AI is. The subtitle of the book says it well, How to Think About Writing in the Age of AI. So you're really focusing your critique on writing. And in fact, I think to be extra generous, you must have done this. You found a use case and shared it with the readers that you found ChatGPT actually to be helpful. And what happened there was a book that you wanted to go back into and retrieve some of your notes. But rather than flipping through the whole book to find the right section, you just queried ChatGPT about the outline and the summary of the book so that you could zero in on the section where you wanted to find it, and you were able to find the section you needed. This sounded like it was genuinely useful and something you might use again, but that was in contrast to another use case that you relate in the book of training ChatGPT on a collection of your columns. You've written a column for the Chicago Tribune for a long time. Feeding all of that in and then asking ChatGPT to write another column in your voice. And that did not end well. Can you talk about the difference between those two experiments, one of summarizing an existing book and a second of generating new content?
Yeah, so that first example was a book by Marianne Wolfe, who is a scholar of reading, called Proust and the Squid. I had read it close to when it came out, which was 10 or 12 years ago, something like that. I had intended to write about it, but never did. So I had all my marginal notes in it and this kind of thing. And just as an experiment, I went to ChatGPT and asked for a summary, a chapter by chapter summary, like what is each chapter about, as a kind of shorthand that allowed me to zero in on the thoughts that I, the area where I had recorded my thoughts when I read it. So, as a kind of repository of summarized information that I can't keep in my head, right? And I have shelves and shelves full of books with my writing in them. And if I'm going to go back to that writing, I have to start just leafing through every page to find the stuff. If I can use this tool to access that more quickly, that's a time saver without sacrificing any of sort of my human input into it. With the column, I trained what ChatGPT, what these people call an agent, on 10 or 12 examples of my column. It's 600 words or so. It's always within five words either side of that because it's a very specific format every week. And as I say in the book, it quote unquote read me sort of accurately. It summarized the tone and approach of the column with some fidelity to how I think about it. And then I asked it to try to write a column about a book that I was not going to write a column about because the Tribune had already covered the book. It was a sort of joint biography of Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, the movie reviewers who started in Chicago when I was a kid. and I'd sort of followed all along. And the ChatGPT, I gave it a long prompt. It was probably at least 50, 60, maybe 100-word prompt about, this is the book. I want to mention my Chicago connection because this is a Chicago audience. I want to say something about how Siskel and Ebert popularized critics talking about movies on television, blah, blah, blah. And it spit out a version of me that was not wholly divorced from me, but because of that was sort of horrifying. In animation, they talk about the uncanny valley, where sort of as animated figures get closer and closer to human, they get creepier and people are turned off by them. The example, at least the example that works for me, is that movie, The Polar Express, where that motion capture technology, where it's like animated Tom Hanks face, and it's like, I don't know, weirds me out. We can both get closer to the uncanny valley and then cross it with these digitally generated videos, right, that these can do. The ChatGPT me was like me. I joke in the book, like it's like Spinal Tap, like it goes up to 11. Like it was me, but it was like extra intense and it was sort of like cloying and weird. That said, it was sensible. It sort of said some things that if you didn't look too close, you'd be like, well, that's reasonable. Like somebody who's reading a column and doesn't care about it would say, okay, I guess that's him. So there could be a temptation there for somebody who doesn't actually enjoy writing like I do, doesn't like mining their thoughts and putting them down and sharing them with people. But it was a good lesson to me in that we absolutely could begin to fall into a trap that allows that output to substitute for the human output, because it is similar, but it's quite literally uncanny. They do these experiments around like if people like AI art or AI poetry more than human poetry, and they often say, oh, I like the AI poetry more than human poetry. And what they like about it is that it's understandable and accessible and easy, where human poetry is weird and spiky and sometimes confounding. And what that asking it to write that column really reinforced for me is the importance of maintaining our interest in the weird, the spiky, the human, because we could fall into this pit where it's like, oh, that uncanny thing, that's good enough. And if we don't have enough experience discerning those things, those differences, or developing our individual tastes around writing, we may not know the difference between, I sound like a horrible snob, but it is, it's the difference, it's, I was going to say the difference between good and bad, but it's really more like the difference between something that induces you to look closer and look again versus something that is quite literally designed for you to skip off of and move on. And the AI output is designed for you to just sort of have this glassy, smooth experience. And somebody who spends a lot of time reading and writing, that's just fundamentally uninteresting to me. But for people for whom this isn't their passion, they might be like, oh, that's what it's for. I experienced that and I've glanced off and I'm going to go about my day happy. But I honestly think that's going to make ourselves duller and dumber over time. And it sort of scares me that we could give into those temptations.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with John Warner, author of the new book, More Than Words, How to Think About Writing in the Age of AI. You can find links to John's books and his columns at the playlist, which is available at tectonic.fm. tectonic.fm. Just click the playlist link for the John Warner Show. Let's go ahead and listen now to the second half of my interview with John Warner here on Tectonic. Yeah, you have this really effective image in the book about Tang, which I remember, like you, I'm a child of the 80s, and I remember the TV commercials of astronauts drinking Tang in a space capsule somewhere, and I want Tang just like the astronauts. And it's an orange-like sugar drink, but it's not orange juice. You write in the book, if I remember correctly, something like, if all I ever drank was Tang, I would have no idea that it was not nearly as good as real orange juice. But given that I have tasted both Tang and orange juice, I know the difference. And I know Tang is what it is, but orange juice is better. It's more real, it's more authentic to what oranges actually taste like. And I think that's a perfect analogy for the risk we're running by normalizing writing, I'm putting that in quotes, being spat out by ChatGPT and other AI tools. Because if it gets, just as you just said, John, if it gets fully normalized and we have, let's say, a generation or two coming after us who have never really experienced deep reading of human writing, then we're in trouble as a species because of all the reasons we talked about earlier in this conversation, that writing is thinking. Writing is dependent on embodied experience. I mean, actual human writing is one of the most important legacies that we can leave. And if our species loses the taste for that writing, loses the taste for orange juice, never having tasted an orange, and starts building its cognitive pathways around Tang, boy, are we in trouble.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is true of reading too, right? Like, there's nobody I know who writes who didn't start first as a reader. Reading is the fodder that allows me to go write. It's literally the byproduct of another unique intelligence that allows me to consider my own thoughts and form my unique intelligence. And the Tang orange juice analogy is a great example of writing as thinking. Because I spent so many years teaching primarily first year college students writing. And I would speak of writing and reading in these terms. And each successive year, that experience was more foreign, less familiar to my students. And that's really what kind of started to break my heart around it, because I realized we were denying them because of the structures of schooling, the imperatives around testing and proficiency and all these things that I cover in my previous book, Why They Can't Write, that they had been left without this part of life that I had just considered fundamental to who I am. And I think for folks of our generation, it's true for a lot of, my wife is a couple years younger than me, but she like reads every night still, right? She's not a writer, she's a veterinarian. She goes to her book club with her friends who still all read. It's like we take this for granted. And yet if you talk to sort of a young person about like reading for pleasure or what they get out of reading, they see it as a kind of purely instrumental thing where you look for information and then parrot this back on a test. I use a quote in the book from Sam Bankman-Fried, the now disgraced crypto fraudster, who this is a paraphrase rather than a quote, but he was interviewed by a journalist before he was exposed, who asked him about books, and he said something like, I feel like if you had to write a book, you effed up, you made a mistake, and it could just be some bullet points in a blog post. And Sam Bankman-Fried is a man in his 30s. He's not a child. He's not 18. And yet he had gone through his entire education and arrived at a point that thought the experience of reading is the same in a list of bullet points as it could be in a book. That's the part that sort of keeps me up at night, because the cultural and market forces behind this technology are furthering that notion that not only is it okay to only drink Tang, maybe you don't even need to drink the Tang, just let it generate the Tang. My friend Audrey Waters, who has this great book called Teaching Machines on the History of Education, she talks about the culture of education that these people, a lot of these people, have internalized. And it really is like the Matrix, where they want a world where you can just sort of download the knowledge into your portal, and then you just have this. As though the experience of achieving that knowledge or skill or ability is meaningless. It's just having it. And again, to me, it's downright creepy. But again, as a 55-year-old guy who's lived through some stuff, and like I was a mediocre student, I was not like inspiring in any of these things. But I would not trade my apprenticeship in things like writing or like I played hockey when I was a kid, or I play the drums now. Those apprenticeships and learning are part of the pleasure, because you then get to get better and you look back and think, wow, I'm better at this now. I can look at my master's thesis sort of through parted fingers, horrified at these things that I did, when I was 27 years old, and think like, wow, okay, I am a better writer today than I was then. I'm a better reader than I was then. I'm smarter in a lot of ways and dumber in some others, and I'm on this sort of path of life. And they seem to reject this as a kind of experience of being human and think that there's something here to be perfected as opposed to experienced. And again, that's just not where I'm at. It's like that guy, that dude who's trying to live forever by eating like nuts and taking every supplement known to man and cryo freezing him. I don't even, I know he's like getting plasma injections from his kid, his 17-year-old kid. I mean, this is a mental disorder. This is not life. One of my messages in more than words is like, hey, we're here to live. We're not here to just be inputs and outputs in a marketplace. We have existences that matter.
Yeah, you had one of the great pithy responses to the tech bros in this book. You say, reading and writing are being disrupted by people who do not seem to understand what it means to read and write. And I like the use of the word disrupted because that is their favorite verb. And yet they have no understanding of what it means to read or write, or as you say, how to be a human being. What is life about? All these schemes, they're just pointed at turning all of us into meat puppets for some algorithm. They want to normalize their technology as the only mode of existence. And yet, the bros seem to be winning, at least at the moment. I should point out to listeners that for a good couple of sections in this book, you are talking about AI and writing in the classroom, both in high school and in higher ed, and what it means for us to be normalizing some of these AI platforms for use by educators, foisting them onto students. I want to read something that you wrote along these lines. You say, writing in February 2024, Adam Kotsko, a longtime professor at a liberal arts college, remarked that after routinely assigning around 30 pages of reading for a class period, quote, students are intimidated by anything over 10 pages and seem to walk away from readings of as little as 20 pages with no real understanding. Since your book came out, I've seen other columns come out written by college professors saying basically the same thing, that through the normalization of these digital devices and digital platforms on today's students, they don't seem to have much attention span or even cognitive faculty to engage with any significant text.
Yeah, one of the things I think it's important to recognize here is that whatever is going on with students in this realm is not really the fault of students. They are fulfilling the role we give them in our system of schooling and responding to the incentives of the system that rewards them for these things. Part of what's going on probably is the distraction of smartphones and this kind of stuff, right? Like we, even those of us who developed all these skills prior to this technology being available can recognize the ability of these things to distract us. But really, if you look at the nature of school for the last 20, 25, 30 years as a sort of narrative of school reform around testing and accountability has been the lay of the land across the country. We have bled out reading for curiosity, interest, pleasure in exchange for short excerpts, things that can be easily tested, things that do not support ambiguity or different interpretations because it's hard to test on passages that are that way. In my book, Why They Can't Write, I talk about an example, a hypothetical example from the kind of standardized test around reading that we give using the Shel Silverstein poem, The Giving Tree, which is about a tree that endlessly sort of gives up itself to this child who grows into an adult in order so the child could do things. And there's many different interpretations of this poem, if you know it. Some see it as a sort of like Christ-like sacrifice, the notion of agape, a sort of selfless love. Others see it as a story about the human selfishness and this kind of stuff. And a reading would support any number of interpretations of this poem. This is why it's a poem that was written in the 1960s or 70s and continues to be interesting today. But if we're going to ask a question about it on a standardized test, we can only support one answer. And so we train students to find that answer. And we narrow the kind of response we allow to reading to the point where the things that they're asked to write don't require them to dig into their own response, to their own cognitive process. It's a sort of, we're just going to go mine for the surface level thing that we can agree is accessible in a quote unquote objective way. And so when students would arrive in my first year writing class and not have the stamina to read like a 10-page article, it would bum me out, but I wouldn't blame them. And so if we want things to be different, we have to get at the root of it. It's not just, hey, you can't use a large language model to do your work. It's we have to give students work that requires them to stretch themselves and develop these capacities. And I'm here to testify as somebody who's taught hundreds, if not thousands, of college freshmen. They like it. They're hungry for this sort of experience. They don't like being bored by school. So it's not like there's no desire for this. We just don't really incentivize it with the way we structure these things, unfortunately.
So in this book, you're sharing some of the examples of exercises that you put your college students through. And I read those and I think, wow, I wish I had John as a writing teacher in college. The exercises sound fun and engaging, and I can see how they would help. And I know you also have a book called The Writer's Practice, which has some of these exercises for anybody who wants to pursue those on their own. In terms of other solutions outside the classroom, I like how you write about the idea of resistance to these new technological platforms. At one point, you say, avoiding the influence of the algorithm requires a conscious effort of resistance. Getting a book recommendation from your local bookseller or librarian or friend is a small act of resisting the algorithm. And of course, that's double resistance because on the one hand, you're talking with a human, and on the other hand, you're getting a book to read. So I like that one a lot. What are some other things that people can do in their daily lives to start fostering a more meaningful life of reading and writing and thinking that you're advocating for in this book?
It's really a kind of consciousness around making choices. You're a great example. You're at WFMU. You're a station that is curated by radio personalities, DJs, not a fake Spotify algorithm. And the experience of listening to a radio show curated by a real human is fundamentally different than your Spotify playlist. The same way, if you ask me what book you should read is different than Amazon's other people who read this book have read these other books, right? What I've started doing is just being conscious of when I've allowed an algorithmic process to substitute for a human one, either by seeking out input from other humans or searching inward, right? I think this is a healthy thing. In the book, I talk about another book I really like by Kyle Chayka, a New Yorker staff writer called Filter World, where he sort of goes around and he looks at the world and sees that we've kind of Instagrammed life. Talks about being in the same coffee shop in Singapore and Budapest and Los Angeles. And it's really sort of I had an epiphany reading the book because I'm like, oh yeah, this I've been walking around in that world. The things like reading, it's as simple as saying to yourself, I'm going to read today, and then setting aside a time to do it. And a time like not right before bed. So just about every day after lunch, I sit on the couch in my office and I read. And I read not for anything, any reason other than to read. I read all day, right? For my work, like I'm reading for a purpose, but it's just, this is the book I'm reading just to read. And maintaining that practice has become a kind of core driver of my own contentedness. I'm from the Midwest and fairly low key. I don't have a lot of ups and downs, highs and lows, but I realize when I'm not reading, when I'm not engaged, I get cranky because I'm not taking that time out to do it. And if people just are sensitive to their own experience of their day-to-day, moment-to-moment lives, I think they would find that adopting some of these practices would be good for them, would have happy benefits. We convince ourselves that we don't have time for them, but I've come to believe it's the opposite.
Okay, John, all this talk about reading and book recommendations brings up one more question. You are a weekly columnist at the Chicago Tribune, where you write as the Biblioracle. You also write a newsletter called The Biblioracle Recommends, and I'll put links to these on the playlist. One thing you do as the Biblioracle is when people send you the last few books they've read, you give them a single book recommendation. So, John, could I get a recommendation on the spot? And
Sure.
I'll make it easy for you. My reading, first of all, is all over the place because I'm always reading books for this show. And I, outside of that, have certain courses I set up for myself. Like last year, I read all of Plato, and now I'm going through Homer. But other than those, I like these long literary works. So I loved Proust, In Search of Lost Time. I finally finished it, and it was tremendous. And more recently, I'm now going through Anthony Pohl's A Dance to the Music of Time. Where should I go after Proust and Pohl?
Ooh, okay. So that's my brain goes a number of different places. I'll think out loud for you and for the sake of the audience. Part of me would partially zig to your zag and tell you to read something that's pretty epic, but not quite as cerebral, I guess, which would be a book like Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. Like you would appreciate the same kind of sweep.
I've read it and I loved it. I love
Yeah, okay.
Lonesome
All right,
Dove.
so I'm on target. So I'm gonna reach to my second thought, which I'm gonna guess you haven't read this, but I could be wrong. There's a Canadian writer, Robertson Davies, who's written a lot of books, including a couple of trilogies, and one is called the Deptford Trilogy, and the first book in that is called Fifth Business. It's a little Proustian. It's sort of a story of a life of characters related to this particular region in Canada, starting with one character in the Deptford trilogy. Great books. I think the entire Deptford trilogy probably clocks in at maybe 1,300, 1,400 pages over three books. So you get to sink your teeth into it for a while and get lost if you're that kind of reader. So that would be my pick.
Love it. Thank you. I'm just amazed looking at the archive of these Biblioracle newsletters and columns. You must have read an unbelievable number of books in your lifetime to be able to come up with these recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is I literally grew up in a bookstore. My mom started a bookstore in my hometown when I was a year old. And so I would like go after school and just sit in the store and read books. And because of that good fortune, and living in a house filled with books, like I was reading like grown-up books when I was not yet a grown-up, right? Like I was reading like Robert Ludlum, like The Bourne Identity and that kind of stuff, Frederick Forsyth when I was like 11, 12 years old. I was reading Tom Wolfe. I read The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test when I was 15. I ended up doing my high school term paper about Tom Wolfe in the style of Tom Wolfe, which got me a bad grade because my teacher didn't know what I was doing. So that's part of it. And I read all the time. I probably read between 75 and 100 novels a year. I sample many more. Like I probably only finish about one out of every three books that I start at this point. And part of that's it's a professional obligation, right? Like I write about books for these places. And so I'm always reading. But I went to graduate school for literature and creative writing. So I've read like all like we had to read like Ulysses and Proust and Vanity Fair and Tom Jones and these sorts of, it's just part of the study. I know I'm an outlier in terms of sort of regular people, but of like the readers and writers like that I know, we're mostly like this. And don't get me wrong, I watch television and fart around and do that kind of stuff too. But ultimately, reading is just something I come back to as a experience that is unlike any other. I tell students all the time that, if they're amazed by like technology, like virtual reality goggles or something, I tell them like if you read and you really read and experience that sort of loss of time and flow state where your mind is connected with somebody else, some text, somebody else's mind, that's virtual reality. I mean, that's like a Vulcan mind meld thing. And to the extent that students have not experienced that or haven't experienced it enough, I think part of my responsibility as their teacher was to help them do that. But most students still, at least up until a certain point, like every student I had read like the Harry Potter books, and they like, oh yeah. Like I could live in that world. Like that's what reading is. That's virtual reality. That's even better than going to Universal Studios and pretending to be a wizard. It's actually in your mind. And we know this, right? Like if you read to a young child, they're captivated. If once they can read for themselves, if they're given the opportunity, they will do it all the time. To the extent that we put other forms of stimulus in front of them, shame on us. But there's nothing that prevents children from developing those sorts of reading habits that I was lucky enough to develop when I was a kid through no intention. Nobody ever said, I'm going to make this kid a reader. They just put me in front of books and let me loose.
Well, you're making a great case in your new book for the importance of reading and writing and thinking and feeling, and in all respects, how to be a genuine human being in this age of technological invasion. I really enjoyed your book, and I recommend it to Tectonic listeners. The book is More Than Words: How to Think About Writing in the Age of AI, as published by Basic Books. And written by you, John Warner. John, thanks again for being on the show today.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with John Warner, author of the new book, More Than Words: How to Think About Writing in the Age of AI. And I hope that interview gave you a good sense of where John stands on the issue, and I happen to agree with him that AI has uses here and there. As I said in the interview, it's not a categorical condemnation of AI as a set of tools, as a set of technologies. It's not that. That's not the point of this interview. Instead, he's got a rather focused point to make, which is that writing is not something that AI can do. For everything that it maybe can do in this and that circumstance, writing is not one of those skills. Yes, it can generate text. Sure, it can generate text in the way that it can generate extruded audio product that some people call music, and the same thing with images, and maybe it can you can have some fun with that. Text, you know, extruded text glop may be useful in some circumstances if you want some throwaway text, but it's not writing. Let's just not kid ourselves about writing. Writing, as John points out in the book, writing is thinking. In fact, he says at one point, if you want to write anything, you have to start with a thought. You cannot start writing without a thought of some sort. It can be an idea. It can be an image in your mind. It can be a notion or a hypothesis of some sort, or maybe you just have a feeling that you want to put into words. There's going to be some sort of a thought that begins the writing process. AI does not have thoughts. LLMs don't think. They use statistics to put together tokens, which we can roughly think about like words. It's not an exact definition, but let's just think about it this way, that this machine uses statistics to guess which word is going to come next in a sequence. It has no idea about the point of the little essay that it's writing. It has no idea. No idea about context, nothing. It's just using statistics. It's advanced computational statistics, putting one word in front of another, and then finally putting a period at the end of the sentence, and then going forward and doing it again for the next sentence. And as I say, maybe you find that helpful in some respects, but don't kid yourself that that's some kind of writing. And where this becomes so important for us to understand what writing is as we talked about, John and I talked about, in the context of education. Because here, we're bringing up the next generation. They are being tempted by the tech bros to use these tools to generate text rather than writing. And that is leading to a general de-skilling of this entire generation. They're losing the capacity to think. They're losing their attention span. They're losing the vital experience they should be getting in school about how to read and how to think critically and how to come up with thoughts and how to then take those thoughts and create cogent arguments out of that, or cogent, you know, stories. If you want to talk about creative writing, anything, any kind of writing, the students today are losing that capacity because the system is foisting these tools on them and saying, oh, this will write it for you. No, it won't, because they don't write. They don't write. AI does not write. So we shouldn't be telling the students that it can write anything for them. And so for a lot of teachers and professors out there working tirelessly, trying to do the right thing by these students, they're now in the position of trying to play whack-a-mole, find which students used ChatGPT to generate this or that, and then take the appropriate actions and trying to guide these students back to a better path, better for their benefit in the long run, to say, hey, don't use these tools. But in the meantime, when the teachers and professors, when these educators are spending so much time trying to police the use of LLMs, they're having less time available for instruction. So on the playlist, if you go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, I put several links. There's this one link I put on called The Average College Student Today. It's a column, an essay written by someone whose pen name is Hilarious Bookbinder. And this person writes, quote, most of our students are functionally illiterate. This is not a joke. By functionally illiterate, I mean unable to read and comprehend adult novels by people like Barbara Kingsolver, Colson Whitehead, and Richard Powers. I picked those three authors because they are all recent Pulitzer Prize winners, an objective standard of serious adult novel. Furthermore, I've read them all and can testify that they are brilliant, captivating writers. We're not talking about Finnegan's Wake here, but at the same time, they aren't YA, that is young adult, romantasy, or Harry Potter either. I'm not saying our students just prefer genre books or graphic novels or whatever. No, our average graduate literally could not read a serious adult novel cover to cover and understand what they read. They just couldn't do it. They don't have the desire to try, the vocabulary to grasp what they read, and most certainly not the attention span to finish. Students are not absolutely illiterate in the sense of being unable to sound out any words whatsoever. Reading bores them, though. They're impatient to get through whatever burden of reading they have to and move their eyes over the words just to get it done. They're like me clicking through a mandatory online HR training. Students get exam questions wrong simply because they didn't even take the time to read the question properly. Reading anything more than a menu is a chore and to be avoided, unquote. Again, that was from the essay, The Average College Student Today, written by Hilarious Bookbinder. You can find that on the playlist at tectonic.fm. These are the stakes, friends. What do we want to teach the next generation? What kind of society do we want to build? Do we want a society where people have the ability to think? Or do we want to abdicate that and let the tech bros deliver these statistical plagiarism machines to pretend that they're doing the thinking for us? I know which one I'm going to choose. I got a great book recommendation from John Warner, and I hope that you too will consider picking up a book and diving in. That's about all the time I have this evening. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, I have just a little bit of homework for you. Speaking of educators and school and everything, homework. But the homework is the same as last week. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And there's really only one song I could play for John Warner as author of More Than Words, but no, I'm not going to play that version of More Than Words. I've got another version of More Than Words that I like better. This is More Than Words by Marissa Nadler and Stephen Brodsky. Thanks again, everybody, for joining, and I'll see you next time.
And good evening, and welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm Dave Mandel, your host, here every Monday at 7 p.m., following hot on the heels of Mark Hurst and the Tectonic Show, from the sublime to the sublime. And I have a lot of great music for you tonight, about an hour of it. And let's start kind of quietly tonight, okay? Start gently. We're going to hear some music from Italy. I think I have a number of Italian things to play for you tonight. Not a big surprise. And let me update the playlist here. Okay, that's done. We're going to hear a group called Daedalus. They were an Italian group active in the early 70s and very obviously influenced by the Soft Machine, I would say that should be clear, or the Canter, so-called Canterbury groups, Canterbury sound, a lot of electric piano, really nice, We'll start gently. So this is going to be a track called Santiago, I think, if I haven't messed up. Yeah, Santiago, from a self-titled album from this group, Daedalus, Italian group, 1973.